So, Renee, what is a naturopath? How would you explain it to someone if they just asked you what you do?
So a naturopath essentially works on restoring balance to the whole body. And I suppose I can kind of talk to this how I specialize in the fertility space. And if you were to go to a doctor with fertility issues, they're kind of essentially looking at your reproductive organs or your uterus. And it's very much like system-based, whereas a naturopath will kind of look at, you know, all of the environmental stresses, diet, lifestyle, mental, emotional health to help restore balance and improve fertility. So I would say that a naturopath is looking for a root cause of something as opposed to just looking at a system, which is what conventional medicine would treat.
So what does it look like if someone says, I need help? Because I've had an experience, you know, in my own journey with my wife, you know, because we have a child and, you know, we got pregnant and we had this whole journey. Like, yeah, what does it look like when people come to you and like, what are you kind of looking for and addressing?
So we spend quite a considerable amount of time with our clients. So anywhere from, you know, an hour and a quarter to an hour and a half for that first consultation. And we're taking a thorough case history, which I think is the difference, right? You go to a doctor and you're hard pressed to get 10 to 15 minutes out of them. So we're taking a thorough history that's looking at, you know, family history, anything that's happened in your younger years in relation to different sicknesses that you've had. You know, history of menstrual cycle, any issues that you had when you were younger or currently. And we're really kind of, you know, putting together the pieces of the puzzle of the individual in front of us. And then we are going, right, are there any dietary changes that need to be made? Are there any lifestyle things that could be impacting this situation? And then once we've kind of covered off those things, we have things like herbs and supplements that we can utilize. We do send our clients away to get pathology tests. We also have functional tests that we can do that you wouldn't necessarily get at your GP or specialist. So we kind of have lots of tools in the tool belt. But I will say that most commonly people are not really addressing the things that are absolutely free to us, like sleep, water intake, movement, you know, getting outside in nature, like all of these things that are just readily available.
And free. And I think exactly. That's where I struggle with the system, in air quotes, is that it's, you know, it's quite rare, and I don't know everybody, but it's quite rare for them to recommend free things because there's no kickback for them or there's no real interest. And maybe they think it's just common knowledge, but in my experience as a personal trainer, people are reaching for supplements and reaching for pills before they reach for their pillow to go to bed or put their phone down in another room and go to sleep. I definitely, you know, I'm definitely with you on that one. What's a quick story or someone you helped with recently? Because, you know, it's many people kind of are aware of what naturopaths do or how they kind of help people, but there's also a lot of people that don't. And, you know, myself included, I'm not massively aware. That's why I wanted to really have you on the podcast. Like, what's a story where you've recently helped someone?
Okay. So I had a client who came to me with an quite a rare autoimmune condition. She had been seeing a rheumatologist about it because it was affecting her skin, and there was lots going on. And basically she was told to go on a really, really harsh medication, methotrexate, I believe, just really, really strong. And her symptoms at this point were quite mild. The underlying issue with the client that I saw was stress. Like stress was impacting like every facet of her life. And I talked to her at length about it from the very first time we started working together. Eventually, we did a functional gut test. So that's basically a poo sample that gets sent overseas. And we get to see exactly what's going on in her gut and to see if there's anything that, you know, is affecting her body. And sure enough, one of the markers was indicative of high stress. So there in black and white, I was able to show her that her stress was greatly impacting her gut health, which was then potentially affecting her autoimmune condition. And it just was, I suppose, the switch that finally kind of made it all sink in for her that she needed to get on top of it. So we worked on her gut. She started implementing different practices, you know, things that she was doing at home, but also actually going to different classes and other physical therapies to help with her stress levels. And she asked the rheumatologist if she could push back the medication start date and just keep doing what she was doing and check back in 3 months. Anyway, she went back in at the 3 month mark and had all of the tests done again and was shown to be in remission without ever starting that medication.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. That's awesome. So how do you tell someone to stress less? Like, what's the practical steps? Because it's, you know, oh, just go and stress less, you know, go on a holiday, you know, kind of like what comes to mind. But yeah, like, what were some of the things that you recommended her do? Because a lot of people need to stress less.
Absolutely. We all do. We are all doing so much more than, you know, what they did back in the 50s, like especially women who are kind of, you know, wearing multiple hats. So this particular client, she worked quite a high-powered job. She's also a mum. She was also wanting to have a second child through IVF and was worried about her age. So you can kind of already see all the different hats that she was wearing. And it, yeah, like it's so simple to say stress less, but when you are a mum, that's really hard because your life is dictated by small people. So the things that I try and kind of tell my clients to do is not to, like, you know, book in the massage and just go, right, on Friday I've got that massage booked and that's going to help me. Like, yes, that's wonderful, but that's like putting all of the emphasis on this one event later in the week. You need to be doing things throughout the day that just provide like mini resets for your nervous system. So focusing on the mundane things that happen throughout the day, boiling the kettle. When I'm boiling the kettle, I'm going to put my legs up the wall, or I'm going to take some deeper belly breaths. When I use the toilet, I'm going to do some belly breaths. If I'm in the shower, I'm going to focus on the belly breaths. And the thing with the belly breath is that it tells our nervous system that we're safe, and it puts us in that parasympathetic nervous system or rest and digest. Whereas for most of the day, we are chest breathing, and that puts us in our sympathetic nervous system. So just like a simple thing like that, just trying to like go, right, I'm going to have these mini resets throughout the day, and that's going to help kind of recalibrate my nervous system. And then if you can, doing something, you know, before your children wake up and maybe in the afternoon, but it's different for everybody.
It depends on, you know, many factors that I've understood lately, you know, if they've slept well, if you've slept well, or if you're just lying there staring at the roof when you should be asleep and things like that. And just finding the time to do things like that is quite rare as, yeah, you know, I'm not a mother, myself, but just seeing it.
Also to add, like if you're a single mother, or in my case, my partner leaves at 5:30 in the morning and he gets home around dinner time. So there's so many different elements to, you know, how much time someone has to dedicate to these things.
Mm, yeah. And resources too, you know.
Yeah.
What have you seen to be the most common things that women are struggling with when trying to fall pregnant? Oh, sorry, not when trying to fall pregnant, as we talked about, that's very different, but when being pregnant.
I think knowing what to eat. Some people, we've got this long list of things that we're told not to eat, and it can be really confronting when, you know, you've been trying for so long to fall pregnant, and then all of a sudden you're pregnant and you're like, oh my God, I can't get a salad from the salad bar. And now they're telling me hummus is, I can't have hummus and I can't have rock melon, all of these things that are good foods. And so what often happens is people will often eat fast food because that's not on the list. And this is 100% true. People don't know what to eat. And then what ends up happening is, and this is kind of generally across the board, my female clients are under eating, specifically protein. And when you think about pregnancy, you're literally growing skin, muscles, a brain, bone, neurotransmitters, like all of these things, while also trying to keep your own body functioning, your own brain functioning. And women are under eating protein, like across the board.
So how do you get that up? Because I deal with a lot of people under eating protein as well. They're not necessarily pregnant, but a lot of people, you know, very high in carbohydrates and fats and just not much emphasis on protein. So what are your hacks to get protein in their diet?
So I try and get them to aim for like a ballpark of say 30 grams breakfast, lunch and dinner, and then a couple of protein focused snacks throughout the day if they're into snacking. So I give them a list of different things that they can do for breakfast. So if they like a sweeter breakfast, they can go more of the yogurt, granola, berries. I don't mind throwing in a quality whey protein. Then I give them like a really great snack list, like cheese, cottage cheese, tinned salmon, hummus, jerky, all of these things, and then give, generally dinner's fine. That's where they're actually nailing it. So even just saying like, make more at dinner because you're already cooking, and have that at lunch. And just kind of putting the emphasis on the fact that they are growing a human and they need that protein, like it's vital. And I think when you put it into that perspective, it sinks in a little bit more. And then because so many women experience nausea in pregnancy, having protein is going to stop that blood sugar dip from happening, which nausea will come after that blood sugar dip. So we're kind of keeping that sustained energy and balanced blood glucose levels from that protein focus.
Do you find that they don't really want to eat protein though? Like just in terms of, you know, when you're feeling nauseous, the desire for protein heavy foods is not really there. Like, I'm not sure, but yeah. This is just kind of, you know, in my experience, like they don't really feel like, you know, eating chicken breast or eating a steak, like when they're nauseous, you know, it's easier to reach for things that are, I guess, a bit, you know, like you said, maybe fast foods or anything, because it's like just to get some food in, like I just need to eat, I just need to get food in. Have you found that or is that just me?
Oh, no, it's 100% the way. And I'm not talking to hyperemesis gravidarum, which is this sickness that occurs all throughout pregnancy. That's multifaceted and that can require medical treatment. But for standard nausea, it's one of those things that if they want to get through it, they just have to try eating something. And and it may not, for that first trimester, it may not be breakfast, lunch and dinner. It may be smaller, more frequent meals across the day, just making sure that they're always pairing whatever they're having with protein. So say it's like, I just want a corn thin, having that corn thin with some cheese on it, just to kind of get that little bit of protein and just having those smaller, more regular meals.
Yeah, when I learned this when I was first getting into fitness, like having protein with every meal, I remember I had a bodybuilder mate, well, he's still my mate, and he was doing a bodybuilding competition, and I was just a teenager at high school lifting weights, and he was like, oh, I have protein with every meal, and I was like, what the hell? You know, like what a freak. Like he's having way too much protein. And now I do it, I feel like my results have been much better. Well, especially when I was going through it. Just, and this is not, you know, obviously from a pregnancy point of view, but just from a muscle building point of view, it just all kind of makes sense getting more protein. And it stops you having this kind of debt of protein that you need to make up for at dinner. Because, you know, like you said, dinner's usually pretty protein heavy for people. Yeah. They know that they kind of have, you know, for dinner, it's like I have my protein, my veggies and my rice or something like that.
Yeah.
Or like a roast dinner or things like that. But breakfast and lunch are usually the ones that suffer. There's a lot of like coffees and muffins or coffees and croissants.
Or no breakfast.
Or no breakfast. And it's just like a black coffee and they just keep rolling through until lunch. And then they have, I don't know, like a salad or a sandwich or something. But the protein portions in sandwiches and salads of that are just so small. I feel like people are just kind of walking away with 15 grams of protein. And then they're at like, they might have a snack of like nuts and chips or something. And then they get to dinner. They've had like 30 grams of protein. They need to hit, I don't know, 150, maybe 120 for females some. And then, you know, but for some bigger dudes, you know, they have to have a lot more. And then they're at dinner like trying to scramble for protein. And then you have to like shove it all in. You have to have this massive steak or this massive amount of chicken. And just having that steady protein with every meal rule, I feel like that really helps kind of rub out that big protein heavy dinner.
Yeah, it does. But the issue comes from people not realizing the importance, because for so many years we've been taught about fat. We've been taught about carbs, like low carb, you know, no carb, keto, fat's bad, fat's good. But like protein's never really been in the conversation, and it is the only macronutrient whose needs change based on different stages of your lifespan. You know, like I think of my parents, they'll probably listen to this, and I've always said to them, like, you eat like birds, and right now you should be focusing on protein to stop any further degradation.
Mm.
But we're not taught that.
It's a hard battle, eh? Yeah. I find that my dad's the same too. Even my nana, who's now in a home, I'm like thinking, where's the protein at? Like in her meals, you know, she's like running through what she has, and there's just, you know, there's none. Where it's so important, where there's dangers of falling and things like that. You know, you really need that. Like it's a bit hard to tell my 90-year-old nana to start resistance training and stuff like that. She like she does her classes and they sit down and stand up and kind of walk around the room and try different things. But that sarcopenia is a real problem, and often it's too late when people are, you know, starting to worry about it, because your body's absolutely not the same at like 30, 40, 50, 60.
Yeah, that's it. Like, you know, they say that once you hit 30, like that's where you have to start really making sure that you're doing the right type of training and building your muscle. And most people are still like, they don't even know that. So it's hard. Like we're preaching to the converted essentially, but like it's such a hard message to get across.
Yeah. I was actually talking about this with my client yesterday, who's a dentist, and you know, just like I guess parents and above, like, and just quite a lot of people just see protein and lifting weights as such a bro thing, you know, like, oh, that's just what gym rats do, you know?
Yeah.
And to some degree that's true. For sure, because it's important for building muscle and all that kind of stuff. But if you look at why they're doing it and understand the mechanisms behind it, it's important. And you know, you don't have to wear a stringer and short shorts and, you know, show your body off at the gym like that to reap the benefits of, you know, a high protein diet and training. And hopefully, you know, conversations like this, and even just with health becoming more popular, I think that people are more aware of lifting weights and stuff like that now, you know. I think people our age and the generations below are kind of being more aware of it and doing it. So hopefully that kind of has a trickle effect, like, I don't know, in the later years when we're old.
I think what's also really great is there's a couple of voices in the, like female voices that are starting to come out on it. So Dr. Stacey Sims, who talks a lot about females training perimenopause and the importance of protein and strength training, and also Dr. Gabrielle Lyon, who she basically says she practices muscle-centric medicine, and she was a geriatrician, so she did see firsthand what a lack of protein was doing to older people versus when they would actually consume protein. So you know, it's really great that there's a couple of female voices coming out, because it reaches a different audience.
Yeah, and for so long they were kind of shunned to the cardio equipment, and, you know, training wasn't really for them. It was, you know, what men do, and you guys just go do some running and stuff like that, which was...
Yeah, do a spin class.
Yeah, do a spin class and just get shouted at and jump around with bad form. It was like, yeah, it's so good that that's on the rise. And, I you know, I've definitely seen it too, just with my personal training, you know, more women that are interested in getting strong and building muscle, which is a conversation that you would never really hear. You know, when I've... Like, even when I first started, like, 5 years ago, not 5 years ago, like, 8 or 9 years ago, it wasn't that popular, you know? And there was still, you know, it was very, you know, there's a women's gym to lift weights, because it wasn't very, you know, comfortable for them to train in front of men, because that was what, you know, they were just shouting and throwing weights around, and, you know, that's not a fun environment to be in for women and for men as well. So it's really cool to see. And it's actually interesting. I've read a couple of studies around creatine supplementation for the elderly population as well, which is really cool. I think that will be a real hard thing. Maybe you slip it into their oatmeal or their risotto or something. And
you can't put it in water. Yeah. But even if you think of like women, so mothers, especially for that kind of the brain factor, you know, like using it for almost like a nootropic. Any mum would know that we forget things. So if there's something that can kind of help our brain function, like 100%, and it's just, yeah, like there's a lot of research now and a lot of you know, Dr. Gabrielle Lyon and Dr. Stacey Sims both talking about it quite openly. I think it's great.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of it too. For the cognitive benefits more recently too, but also, you know, for the obvious muscle building effects, I want to make a quick turn and talk about the pill. How is that impacting women when they're trying to fall pregnant?
How it's impacting is that often women are put on the pill at a young age to regulate, and I say that in inverted commas, their cycle. So first and foremost, the pill doesn't regulate your cycle. It switches off your body's hormones. It essentially like puts them on pause and uses synthetic forms of your hormone to create what looks like a cycle. But a woman does not ovulate when she's on the pill. The bleed that she experiences is actually a withdrawal from taking the pill. Because she's on a sugar pill for a week, and so she bleeds because she's withdrawing. And then later they meet their partner, they talk about having kids, and then they come off the pill. But all of the problems that they had when they were 14, 15, 16 are still there because they haven't been addressed. And then they come off the pill and realize, oh, I thought that the pill was regulating my polycystic ovarian syndrome or, you know, whatever the condition is. And then in their 30s, they're having to address what could have kind of been addressed back when they're a teenager. And so the process of having a child could be delayed while their body figures it out, or they're impatient, or they're not, you know, they're not necessarily working with a naturopath or a nutritionist, and they're just at their doctor, and their doctor's then referring them to a fertility specialist, and they go down the road of IVF. Which is very, very expensive.
Yeah, yeah. My wife actually works in IVF, so I know that firsthand.
Yeah.
So what's, I guess there's many solutions, but what is, you know, I guess a way for them to overcome that?
I'm not, like, the pill isn't a bad thing. I suppose it's allowed women to kind of choose when they want to start having children, right? Instead of feeling like they're fertile myrtle and going to be pregnant years before they're ready. I mean, the fact of the matter is it's a 5-day window each month. And if you actually are able to, you can come off the pill and you can work with someone like me who can teach you the fertility awareness method, where you actually learn your body's signs and symptoms, and we can clearly see when your fertile window is. So you use that window to either use protection and avoid falling pregnant, or if you're trying to conceive, you learn exactly when the fertile window is. So that's one option, kind of going, right, there's something other than the pill, let's explore that. Or you just allow 1 to 2 years before you want to have children to start doing the work on your body in case anything from those earlier years pops up and needs addressing.
Yeah, it's not a, I guess, you know, I'm not too aware of it, but it's not just a just do this and that and then it's going to be fine. It's very multifaceted.
No, I mean, there's certain nutrients that are depleted by the pill. It can affect our microbiome. So even just kind of, you know, addressing those nutrient deficiencies is a start. And some women will come off the pill and they get a cycle and everything's fine. Mm. And I'm not talking to them, but you don't know if that's going to be you, basically.
Mm. Okay. On your Instagram, I read a couple of posts that I'm very interested in, and they were how to avoid endocrine disruptions when... So TTC, is that trying to conceive? Just yes. So I know that I didn't make that up. Cool. So I just want to read out a few things that you did for men and did for women, and then just kind of talk about it. So the things that you've kind of mentioned for men to avoid endocrine disruptions, natural deodorant, ditching your cologne, stopping chewing gum or chewing gum that doesn't have plastic in it, thinking of changing your underwear, and you know, you can talk about the kind of different types if you want to, switching to glass containers over plastic and stainless steel drink bottles. And then for women, some of the things you had were switching to low tox brands for skincare, body and makeup, ditching the perfume as well, eliminating candles or choosing different candles, I think, which my wife has actually done. We don't have candles anymore. And stopping vaping. So what are things like this doing to our body? Because I feel like this is quite a new approach and hasn't really got much attention to most people. You know, like a lot of people aren't thinking about the type of deodorant that they're using. They're not thinking about ditching cologne. They're just like, it makes me smell good, so I'm going to wear it. What's it doing to us?
So endocrine disrupting chemicals, put more simply, are hormone disruptors. So they can mimic the hormones in our body and cause disruptions in them. So things like deodorant, standard deodorant, antiperspirant deodorant, we put it on and we don't perspire because of aluminium within the deodorant. So you're essentially plugging an area that's a detoxification pathway. Our sweat it helps us detox. But these things can make their way into our bloodstream through our skin and wreak havoc on our hormones. There's an amazing woman called Dr. Shanna Swan. She has done her PhD on a compound called phthalates. And phthalates are essentially anything that's in plastic that's flexible. I like to think of like a rubber ducky in your child's bath, which in that hot water can leach into the water or garden hoses. But phthalates are also found in fragrances. And her study specifically was on male fertility because I think it had, when we talk about male fertility, it has more of a shock factor. But she says that if we continue down the path we're on with the amount of these products we have in our everyday life, sperm count will be at zero by 2050.
Crazy.
Yeah. So I've already seen it. I've seen one of my clients had a sperm analysis from her partner 20 years ago, and it was his sperm morphology. So that's like one tail, one head, swimming in the right direction, everything's perfect. His sperm morphology was at 15%, which for 20 years ago was considered low. But these days, with IVF, to do IVF, you only need 4% morphology, meaning that 96% of that sample can be abnormal. They only need 4% to be perfect. Or you can go down the road of ICSI, which is like getting one egg, one sperm in a petri dish. And for ICSI, they only need 1% of the sperm to be perfect. And so the average that I'm seeing now on current sperm analysis, like the best I've seen is like 8%. Mm. So from that client's, sperm analysis from 20 years ago, I've already seen that 50% decrease, which Dr. Shanna Swan is referring to. And it's all from these compounds that we have in our plastic containers, in our colognes, in our plastic drink bottles, in our non-organic underwear, because cotton is one of the most heavily sprayed crops. And they don't care if that cotton is going to make a tampon, a pad, or a pair of underpants, and is getting worn in one of the most absorbable areas of the body.
Mm.
So it's pretty crazy.
Yeah. Like, I'm not even aware of this. You know, this is really interesting stuff. So what are some, like, I know you've made some recommendations. I'm not sure if you have them off the top of your head, but, like, what are some changes that people can make, like some brands maybe that you know off the top of your head that you use, or maybe you refer to other people?
Yeah. So when it comes to deodorant, a good unisex one, my partner and I both use it. It's called Black Chicken Remedies. It's a deodorant paste. It's got a really neutral smell, doesn't smell feminine or masculine. It's just quite a nice smell.
And does that work the same? Like, does it have the same
It's not going to stop you from sweating. And that is the hardest thing when it comes to deodorants.
But does it stop you from smelling?
Well, it does, but if you're someone that does have body odor, that is potentially something that needs to be addressed.
That's because, more of a gut microbiome issue, isn't it?
Yeah, it's could also be like a fungal issue. So we need to know these things, right? As I said, the sweat is a detoxification pathway and we're constantly plugging it up. Mm. Toothpaste, there's some great ones now that you can pick up at the supermarket, like Grant's.
Is that the one with the koala on it?
Yes, and the one without fluoride. Yeah. There is a fluoride-free one. There's some great brands now at the supermarket for things like laundry detergent. So you've got EcoStore, who have a sensitive range of laundry liquid that doesn't have any fragrances in it. There's one at Coles that you can get called Aware. It's got a baby on it. There's Co, which is a multi-purpose cleaning product, KOH. They're now available at Woolworths. There's so many different brands. Switching to organic cotton underpants or bamboo, like Booty, B-O-O-D-Y.
Is that for women and for men?
Both, yeah. Right. At Coles and Woolies, you've got Decor, the glass containers. Every couple of weeks I see they're like 30 or 40% off. So it's not necessarily about going, oh, I need to get rid of everything and this is going to be really expensive. It's about going, right, that's on sale, cool, I'll get a couple of those and I'll get rid of a couple of those, and just kind of start crowding things out when you finish a product. And then another really big one is our cookware, because a lot of our cookware, it's this whole convenience thing. We've got non-stick everything, and that non-stick has Teflon in it. And Teflon is known as a forever chemical. Our body cannot get rid of it. It's actually found in the umbilical cord. Like, it is insane. And so, you know, making a buy once, buy well investment with your cookware, like save up, buy one or two good pans and get rid of the non-stick.
So in terms of the specific thing, like, what do you use to make it non-stick? Because people are kind of doing it, I know some people are doing it a lot in terms of dieting, like trying not to use oils and things like that to reduce their calorie intake. That's just one little example, but, you know, is it just to use oil? Is that the solution?
Well, if you get a really good cast or wrought iron pan, they call it seasoning, and it builds up a seasoning on the pan that almost makes it non-stick. And you do that by putting the pan on high heat, adding an oil that has a high smoke point, using a paper towel to kind of, you know, work it around and let it smoke, and then turn it off. And by doing that seasoning every few times you use it, you're actually making that pan non-stick.
Mm.
But I mean, I also love cooking in fat, so
yeah,
I'm not scared of that.
Yeah, that's something that I loved about your page, you know, running through, you know, kind of understanding your philosophy. And this is something, you know, that my family has definitely started to gravitate towards, like very nutrient dense, you know, like animal-based foods, bone broths, ghees, you know, grass-fed meats and stuff like that. And I think it's slowly getting more awareness, but it's still quite niche. It's still very, I don't know, just people don't know about it. Like, our daughter has bone broth every day. And I was talking to one of my clients here who's a GP, and she was like, that's what we, like, she's from Persia. And she's like, that's what we do, like, back home. Like, it's normal. But over here, it's not really very normal to give your kids bone broth or to give them, like, you know, very nutrient dense snacks and stuff like that. It's more so these, and we kind of look at these baby snacks, like, they're just quite low nutrient density.
They're shit.
Like, yeah, they're like crackers with, like, I don't know, like, random oils and, like, corn, and, like, that's about it. And, you know, it's, I guess it's challenging as a parent to really, I feel like, to nourish your kid. Like, yes, if your kid eats a cracker or something like that, they'll be okay. But I guess it's hard to say what's going on under the hood long term. And you know, we can't really make assumptions, but yeah.
Are you finding that since having your daughter, and she's obviously now on solids, has that really been the eye-opener for you with all of this?
Well, like I said, my wife has been on her own gut journey. So that was, I guess, more so the wake-up call around, you know, correct foods. And, you know, like, I'd never really seen bone broth in my life. You know, like we would kind of drink it after dinner, like a cup of tea. Like, we'd have a bone broth. And I was like, this is, you know, it's quite weird. But when you think about it, it's like such a nutrient-dense way to finish the night. And to just to, like, you know, have all these good nutrient-dense, you know, things from you know, animal-based proteins and things like that. So that is kind of where it started. You know, we're having slow-cooked organic meats, and instead of standard pastas, you know, my wife was having buckwheat pasta, and just making changes like that, and not necessarily having everything low-fat. Like, you know, for milk, I would always have low-fat milk and blah, blah, blah. And then my wife was getting, like, raw milk with, like, heaps of fat in it and stuff. And I was like, oh, I don't know about this. You know, the macros are pretty fat heavy. You know, I was like,
my Fitness Pal's not going to like this.
Nah, because I used to have, you know, I used to have smoothies with all these ingredients in, but, you know, they were low fat and they were berries and all this kind of stuff. And I'd have it, it'd be like 800 calories or something like that. Like, I have a lot of calories to hit throughout the day, but having a lot of fat was never really how I rolled. Like, I liked a high carb diet. And then I started having, like, the full fat raw milk, and I was adding in things like avocados and all this kind of stuff. And then the smoothie was like 1300 calories. I was like, for breakfast. And I was like, oh, geez, you know, but my wife was like, you know, it's so much, you know, there's so much more nutrients in it now for you and all this kind of stuff. So that was really where I got into it. It's really been my wife that's been kind of like the eye opener for me. And she's worked with, do you know Jake Dolishall? And, maybe not. But he's kind of like a gut health, you know, a gut health expert. Him and this other guy have a podcast, and they talk about it. And my wife's had different protocols with using, you know, supplements and things like that. You know, as opposed to going the more Western, you know, medicine route, which is, you know, taking this and taking that. So she's gone.
Or going to see a gastroenterologist.
Yeah, well, yeah, like, you know, there's been multiple things that, you know, we've kind of overcome, but that's kind of where I've come into it. And then, you know, my wife has been doing that with my daughter as well. So I've just kind of been like an observer, because, you know, she takes care of our daughter while I'm working. So, so she's doing food and all that kind of stuff, making, you know, like these pancakes, but they got all these, you know, like healthy fats and stuff in them, and they're all cool, blueberries mixed in and LSA and all this kind of stuff, not this like pancake ready mix that's just full of kind of like empty flour and stuff like that.
Sounds like our household. Glenn always says, before we got together, he's like, I never saw organic blueberries in the freezer, and now they're just, there's that many organic berries in the freezer. And very, very familiar.
Yeah, but when you know, sit down and think about it for a while, it does make sense. And I'm still not 100% there in terms of, you know, reading up on it and being, you know, really aware of it. But I'm making, you know, small changes to improve, because I was just the calorie macro guy. You know, let's just get shredded and be buff. And, you know, that's what I was, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's so much more to the conversation. And especially, you know, a reason why you're on the podcast is, like, you know, women's health and things like that. Because, you know, for women, it's not just about getting shredded and looking buff. You know, it's about, you know, for a lot of them, having kids and doing it in a healthy way, and then the whole postpartum journey and things like that, which I want to quickly touch on. What are some of the most common things that you see women struggling with in the postpartum journey? I know that there are many things, but if you could maybe highlight one or two, that would be really awesome.
I think the biggest thing is that, especially for a first-time mum, there is so much emphasis put on birth as like the thing they're working towards. I can completely respect that because it's something that they've never been through before, and it can seem quite big and scary, and you might hear a lot of stories about it, but they almost put birth as the finish line. Like, yes, I've gotten through that, and all of the work that they've done to get to that point stops, and then they're at home with a baby, and you know, the food that they were making themselves, the supplements that they were taking, all of that stops, when actually in postpartum, especially for breastfeeding women, your needs increase in that time. So there's no caloric increase in the first trimester. In the second trimester, it's about 340 calories extra per day. In the second trimester, it's about 450. When you're breastfeeding, an extra 700 calories is what a woman needs to support breast milk production. So in some women who are not as well nourished, they're kind of like hitting about 500 to 700 mils per day, compared to a well-nourished woman who's producing about a liter and a half of breast milk per day. Mm. So you can see why it's important to still be focusing on that nourishment after you have your baby, because not only are you trying to produce breast milk, but you're trying to heal a dinner plate sized wound on the inside of your body.
Mm.
And we seem to forget that. And we all want to kind of get back to doing things very quickly, but our body needs time to heal. And we live in a society where everybody's not wanting to slow down, basically.
And is there a rush to get in shape as well, that kind of stops them from eating that much food as well? You know, like, there's quite a common, and I'm not saying that, you know, this is what I believe, but there's a lot of, like, even in the media, you know, they kind of, you know, this celebrity had a baby, but like 4 weeks later they're back to where they were, you know. So there's this almost, I don't know, picture painted a little bit in terms of, all right, you've had your baby, like, get back into shape type of thing. But then there's the, you know, you do need more food, you do need to nourish and heal your body. But then on the other side of things, there's some parents that are like, but I want to be, you know, back to my old body and all this kind of stuff. How do they navigate that?
That's a personal journey. And that's, you know, often the whole bounce back, the ideas you may have in your head, that's your own ego. And personally, like towards the end of my first pregnancy, I was like, oh my God, I'm never going to be this person again. Like, the person I know I am now, I'm never going to be her again. And, you know, that doesn't happen for every woman, but it's like this rite of passage that you have to go through. And, you know, like, life is about evolving and changing, and I'm not going to be who I was 5.5 years ago before I had Freya. But I'm so much more now. And I guess it's just like coming to that conclusion yourself. And if you are heavily influenced by what you see and are exposed to, stop following people on social media that are portraying these bounce back culture messages, and focus on, you know, the accounts that are supporting, you know, slowing down, you know, being a present mother, healing, you know, there's plenty of those accounts out there. And so don't don't expose yourself to it.
Yeah. I posted about that yesterday, actually, on Instagram. It was just like, you know, just following the wrong people, you know, because, you know, sometimes I think we were a lot better off when we didn't really see what was going on the other side of the world. And we just kind of knew what was going on in our little circle. I think we felt a lot better about ourselves. Well, I know, you know, as a kid growing up, I didn't have any of that. And,
Me too.
I didn't really worry about any of that. And I see, a lot of, you know, teenagers and kids even, you know, now just worrying, like, I won't say worrying, like they're worrying about everything, but just being aware of what other people are doing, what shapes and sizes they are, what they're wearing, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it's just, I think, personally, you know, like something that you don't necessarily have to be aware of. And it can really rob you of, you know, the things that you have. You know, I remember I was just biking around the neighborhood, and I remember one day, this is just a random story that popped into my head. I grabbed like a, there was like a cat food box on the road, and I put it, like it got stuck in between my tire and my bike. And as I was biking, it kind of sounded like a motorbike because it was rubbing against the wheel. And that entertained me and my friends for hours. Like we were like pretending we're on a motorbike and stuff like that. And it's just playing as a kid, but it's just, you know, I feel like those are the kind of moments we should be getting lost in, as opposed to getting lost in other people's worlds where we're not even experiencing anything.
And just remember, I mean, like it's said all the time, but Instagram or social media is a highlight reel. Just because things look perfect for that person, they're likely still dealing with the same things you are. And you just need to remember that.
Yeah, 100%. And I think there are more pages becoming more transparent. I think they're kind of like, you know, perfect page. Like, even though they're out there, I think they're kind of getting a little bit, you know, people are getting a bit over it because it's just like, well, that's not really realistic.
Exactly.
Or kind of like just seeing it for what it is. But then again, I don't know. Sometimes there's a lot of people that are like just falling for it. And I'm like, what's going on here? Like, you, like, when you're at work or something, or like with your friends, do you not just have this, I don't know, normal brain where you just have normal conversations and, you know, you kind of talk shit and kind of have a bit of banter and all this kind of stuff. But then some people, I don't know, they go online and they see the stuff and then they like, I don't know. It seems like two different people.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't make sense.
It's quite sad, really.
Yeah. One more question before we kind of go into where your fitness has gone and, you know, your story and your journey, I guess. Don't really like that word, but anyway. What's one of the proudest moments, or, you know, like, what are you proud of as a parent?
I'm proud of being an example for my girls. So there's, you know, there's a study that kind of gets talked about a lot about the impact of children seeing their mum exercise or train and their health outcomes as individuals. And, you know, obviously it's going to impact them seeing their father do it as well, which they do see, but there's something about kids watching their mums do these things that has a really positive outcome on their own health. And so everything I do is to show them and to teach them things. And if they can, you know, have a ripple effect or a different health journey, for lack of a better word, then, you know, another child who isn't seeing these, then I've kind of done my job. And I think also the fact that I have the ability to be home with them quite a lot. I work from home. I only practice 2 days a week. And I had a mum who was around when my sister and I were young, and to have the privilege of being there for them is really, really, really important to me.
That's great. To turn to your fitness journey, how has that been as a, you know, I guess as a lady before children and then going through pregnancy, postpartum journey, and then to kind of where you are now? What's that been like for you?
So pre-pregnancy, so I actually, I was doing CrossFit, and that it was actually a really good pivot for me because I'd moved to Sydney and my lifestyle had changed quite a lot. I was working in public relations and there was a lot of socializing and a lot of alcohol that previously wasn't really part of my life. And so I gained some unhealthy kilos, and the whole CrossFit craze came about, and I was like, I needed a bit of a kick up the bum. And so I joined, and it was actually a really good catalyst for me to get into training. However, once I started doing my degree and learning about the beautiful ebbs and flows of the female hormones. And I saw firsthand that there were women coming in from like crazy stressful jobs, then coming in and doing these crazy stressful workouts, how that can impact hormones, stop periods. You know, it was just, it didn't really make sense to me anymore. My partner, Glenn, actually owned the CrossFit gym. So I became a I started working there and I became just doing admin. I became terrible at signing women up.
You're like, are you sure that you want to do this?
Yeah. Are you sure you want to be coming in? You're coming in 6 days a week. And that's, you know, that's what I was seeing, because most often when people would sign up, they would become sick for it and they would literally be going there 6 days a week. And so then I was pregnant with Freya. My training really, really slowed down. I did a lot of Pilates at a local studio, and then we sold the gym and we have a full setup in our backyard. Like, I'm very, very fortunate. But for a couple of years, my relationship with fitness was changing a bit because I didn't really know what was best serving me. What I found after Freya and before I was pregnant with Rana, my second daughter, was that my cortisol levels were a lot higher. I was a lot more stressed, I suppose, from trying to finish a uni degree, being a mum, and the intensity of doing, say, a Metcon at the end of training weights was too much for my nervous system. And so even though I was doing all of the same things, I was not seeing the results that I wanted. And so then I started doing some training with a friend. She was doing a program for me, which was really great. But what I really wanted was structure and kind of like, right, this is where I'm at. This is where the training program's going, and I really needed that structure. Structure determines function, right? And I needed it to be something that I feel in my whole body that doesn't gas me and leave me too exhausted to do everything else that I need to do in my day. And a friend had recommended you, and I started with the 8-week program just as like, right, let's just jump in, see what this is all about. And now I've continued on, and I'm currently in phase 3 of the 16-week female guide.
So what's been the biggest change for you? Is it just, you know, obviously you have the psychological effect of knowing that everything's structured, everything's, you know, going in a certain direction, and it's not just random stuff, which is what I kind of struggle with CrossFit. And I've only done it once, and I love the culture of it, like you said. It's, like, really cool to be a part of. There's, you know... Like, I'm a really competitive person, so I really enjoy that you're kind of competing against everyone, but you're also kind of friends too, so there's that kind of nice balance. But it is quite random. Like, it's quite random. Like, the stuff that you do is just like, oh, okay, today we're doing this. All right, let's go. There's no real goal, which I struggle with for a long-term kind of training trajectory. But yeah, why has kind of, I guess, you know, my programs or the structure, like, why has that taken... Or why has that been so good for you?
I think for me, seeing the gradual improvement, you know, for 4 weeks, you're kind of, you're doing the same movements over. For me, I aim for 4 days a week. That's kind of the most realistic for me. And so for those 4 weeks, you're kind of seeing your increase in weight, and that is so good for your, I don't know, for me, it's like incredible to see, wow, like I started on that weight and now I can kind of push myself more. Or, yes, I finally hit that for my squat, because you've been working on that. The biggest thing for me, so I still feel like I have a bit of a cortisol belly, which I'm working on. And for me at the moment, that's all about, like we spoke in the beginning, regulating my nervous system and prioritizing that. But the training has, my body shape has changed. Like my posture and the muscles in my back and shoulders is so much broader, straighter, like posture's better. I'm holding myself better. On the scales, I've dropped a couple of kilos, but it's more about my clothes fit differently. Like the jeans I have on now are bigger and I only bought them last year. So it's that recomposition of my body.
Yeah, that's one thing that's quite underrated, is like the change of body composition, not just the drop in weight. I've got a that same client I was talking to you about, that's a GP, like I actually train her face to face in the gym here. And she, I don't think she's lost weight, but she looks completely different. Like, yeah, her clothes are just like, she's had to buy new things and buy belts and all this kind of stuff, because it's just like, you know, for women, if they don't lose weight, a lot of them are a bit gutted, you know, they're like, oh, this kind of sucks, you know, I'm just in the same place. But when you kind of see your clothes fitting different and things like that, you kind of understand that there's muscle and there's fat and there's this, you know, nice change of body composition. But it's quite a hard sell sometimes. Especially for
so
me,
so hard. Yeah.
You know, like I'm not a bullshitter, so I'm not like, oh yeah, you know, this is going to happen. You're going to lose 8 kilos in 8 days, type of thing. I'm like, you know, I try to lay it out straight out of the way, so that like if they sign up, we're on board and we're cool. But if they don't, it's like, oh, at least I dodged the bullet. And me trying to explain why this happened and why that happened, it's just easier to kind of get it out in front.
Yeah, I just don't understand this desire to be skinny, like with everything that we've just spoken about, with sarcopenia, with the fact that if a woman has a fall, I think in her 50s or 60s, her risk of all-cause mortality increases, because that fall and the subsequent bed rest is causing that bone density and muscle mass degradation. Like, now is the I'm 39, and I mean, 9 years ago was the time to start, and I'm glad that I was already lifting weights then. But this desire, and I still see it a lot in everyday of being skinny, is just mind-boggling.
Yeah. I feel like it's slightly getting better, but maybe it's my world that I'm in. That's personal training and lifting. You know, I just see a lot of chicks lifting weight, and I'm like, this is really cool. And it's slowly getting towards, you know, being strong as opposed to being skinny. But, you know, I definitely know that there is still that, there's still that desire. And maybe we try to change the conversation of, like, instead of just like losing weight, we kind of talk about losing fat, because that, you know, has that kind of undertone of maintaining muscle mass. But then there has to be that part of lifting weights too. It's a real hard sell, you know? I'm still working on it.
I mean, it's essentially about longevity, really, you know, and having that quality of life, you know, not so much quantity. It's got to be quality. And you say that, you know, you're seeing, you feel like you see it a lot more, and that's your confirmation bias, right? You're in the industry, you're seeing a lot, whereas, like, 100%. I see a lot of people drinking bone broth.
But I think, I don't know. I think people are becoming a little bit more aware of lifting weights, and I hope that, you know, conversations like this can encourage them to lift weights. And it doesn't have to be a bro thing. It doesn't have to be something that only, you know, hashtag Fitspiration mums do and all this kind of stuff. And there's also this myth that I wanted to quickly tackle, that, you know, people are like, oh, you know, I'll get injured if I lift weights, or, you know, it's bad for my bones and all this kind of stuff, where it's literally the opposite. You know, it improves your bone density, because it, you know, you build this resilience to the weight that you lift, and then you have bigger muscles surrounding it. I don't know. I just hope that this encourages you to lift weights and kind of, you know, go through your years to be stronger. And I know it's hard when you're like, you know, especially in your 20s, but even like 30s, it's a bit easier in your 40s and 50s. But like, to understand that, like, as you get older, and I know this of seeing grandparents around and stuff like that, like, it's not too late, but it's much harder to make a bigger difference when you're like 60 years old. It's hard to put some muscle in the bank. Yes, you can still make progress from where you're at. But if I can encourage you to even just lift three days a week, you know, four is awesome that you're doing, but just to kind of, it's not even about looking amazing. It's about like having a quality of life, like standing up with your grandchildren and it not snapping your knees and not like hurting your back and like, you know, just lifting your arm and having like five clicks happen and all this kind of stuff. Like I see it and it's real. And there's that whole, like, you know, as soon as you get 30, things start going downhill and you get injured and all this kind of stuff. But
it does not have to be that way.
Yeah, it really doesn't. I think that, you know, lifting weights is the key to that. And yeah, I stand by that.
And, you know, if you are someone that's experiencing pain, not going to your doctor about it because that's not what they're trained in. Finding a really good physio or body practitioner who, like, do your research. Like, there's a women's health physio that I went to postpartum who all of those women lift weights, whereas I know another women's health physio in the same suburb and they are anti that. They're more the Pilates focus. So choosing a practitioner who is well-versed in the type of training you're doing so that they can help you get back on board and work around that and get back into training and not be like, oh, no, you shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah, I love it. I want to wrap up just with one thing, and I didn't ask you about this, sorry, but just if you have any quote, because I love quotes. If you have any quote that you live by, I think you might have one. I could just feel it. like any quote that you think would encourage people or any quote that you live by that has kind of helped you through times or that you say to yourself to kind of gear you up or any quote that you think will help people out. Do you have one?
It's the stolen quote.
Aren't they all stolen?
Yeah, most of them. I definitely haven't come up with it by myself, but it is, it's from Jocko Willink, Discipline Equals Freedom. And it sounds rigid and structured, but it really does. Like working out at the beginning of the week, the days that you want to train and how that can fit into your week is going to allow that happen and give you that freedom. Doing some meal prep or planning what you're going to be having, what you're going to be cooking for family dinners on the weekend is going to free your mind up during the week so that you've got that extra brain space and you're not every day going, oh God, what am I going to make for dinner? So discipline equals freedom. It really does impact every area of your life.
I love that. And it kind of gives you a bit of a light at the end of the tunnel for doing the hard work because often, you know, discipline is seen as this thing that you have to be like, oh, here we go, you know, have to do this. And you don't really see the result at the end, but that freedom is awesome. I like that. It kind of reminds me of the quote, and I think this is paraphrased, but it's for men and women, but I think the quote was for a man, but like it was like to understand the priorities of a man, look at his calendar, and it's a bit different, but it kind of, you know, like if you schedule things, if you have this kind of discipline, well, this kind of talks about the priorities, like you see what they really care about, because like some people say, oh yeah, I really care about my health, then you look at their calendar, there's like no gym sessions at all, you're like, oh okay, that doesn't really line up. Mm-hmm. But it kind of also does in some part like have that kind of freedom aspect to it, like, you know, I love the calendar of the discipline, but I agree, it gives me that freedom. And it's like, you know, when I work, like I've kind of tried to change my schedule more to like a Monday to Friday type thing, you know, now that I have a daughter, so I can really milk those hours that I have with her in the weekend and not spend it working, which I used to work every single day of the week for ages. Like when I didn't have
priorities change, right?
Yeah. Well, like first of all, when I was single and didn't have a wife, but also, you know, now, and when I didn't have a daughter, I was just like, I'll just work whenever, wherever, it's all good. But now I'm really trying to be disciplined so that I have that freedom at the end and that, you know, really, for me, like I went through yesterday and did my whole calendar again just to like make sure that I even put sleep in. I was like, I'm going to put sleep in so I get a 15-minute reminder that I should be asleep by this time. I know it's kind of stupid.
No, my partner has that every night of reminder. The week.
Really?
Yeah. He gets up at a crazy hour so that he can train before he works because he knows that if he saves that workout until nighttime, there's too many things in his day that can cut into that window.
Mm.
And also he wants to spend it with his family.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I love it. Well, yeah, that's an awesome quote. Thanks, Renee, for jumping on. I appreciate it. How can people find you if they want to work with you? I know we talked about what you did at the start of the of the podcast. Where can they find you?
On Instagram, I am Renee Lynch_naturopath. And through that, you can access my website, my booking link, and other resources.